Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's our last show of the year, and we've got lots to talk about later on the program, including how to handle this year. Author Samantha Irby is joining us. But first, the problem of sexual harassment and how pervasive it is within the American workplace has been a national story for months now. Why it's so pervasive is a big question. People often point to overwhelming cultural norms or unconscious bias. But University of Illinois employment law scholar Suja Thomas says there's also another problem, federal judges. She writes, judges are likely to dismiss cases of sexual harassment or discrimination when they go to court, even with laws like the Civil Rights Act or other broad federal laws that should provide protection. All of this is the topic of her latest book that she co-authored along with Sandra Sperino. It's called Unequal: How America's Courts Undermine Discrimination Law. I spoke with her back in November. Suja, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Suja, I should say, I should warn our audience that I'm going to explain in some rather graphic language some claims that you said were dismissed. And I think it's important to mention them because they seem so egregious when we're talking about sexual harassment. You write about cases where coworkers and supervisors made comments about a woman's breasts, requesting her to lick whipped cream off of them. Other workers, a supervisor asking a female worker to go to a hotel room and spend the night with him. Lots of other things that actually get worse than that. And they all, these sound horrible, and at face value, they sound like classic harassment. How are cases like this getting dismissed by judges?
Yes. There are a number of different procedures as well as what courts call doctrines and inferences that courts use to dismiss cases. There's a procedure called summary judgment that's used before trial, and a judge can decide that he or she thinks that a reasonable jury could not find for the person bringing the case. And so oftentimes that's the procedure that's used, and what a court will do is they'll say, here are some facts from a hostile environment case. That's what they'll call a sexual harassment case. And they'll say, this is not, let's say, for example, they'll say, this is not severe or pervasive enough to actually alter the working conditions of this employee to create a hostile or abusive working environment. And so as a result, we're going to dismiss this case. And this is despite the fact that, as you said, the facts of the case are very sort of bad facts, bad explicitly, things that we have, all of us would never want to have happen to us. And despite the fact that there is really broad language in the statute that provides that someone is not supposed to be discriminated against because of their sex.
And so according to one study, you write about this, there's one study from 2007 that says when employers request dismissal of discrimination claims, which include harassment claims, more than 70% are dismissed in whole or in part. Do you think that's also, that's where is the problem here? Because you talk about federal judges, this is before cases are even going to juries, or there are times even we write about when judges dismiss juries' verdicts.
Right. And so these doctrines and inferences are being used by judges to dismiss these cases. And so this Federal Judicial Center study that you mentioned from 2007 studied about six, I think, district courts and found that all of these cases are being dismissed at a very, very high rate. And you even see some areas of the country, like Atlanta, where the dismissal rate is even higher. And so they use these made-up doctrines and inferences to say, well, we think now that what you and I would think is a factual question is a legal question. So in the example I gave before, the severe pervasive requirement, they'll say, this is a legal question, and I get to decide whether these facts are severe or pervasive enough. And if they're not, then I'm going to dismiss the case. Or they might say a comment that's discriminatory, let's say calling someone the N-word, which unfortunately happens in many workplaces still. Someone calling someone the N-word in January, but then making a decision not to promote them in July, that stray, they'll call it a stray remark, was made in January. It doesn't mean there was discrimination in not giving that promotion in July. So all of these, there's about, we found about 20 different ways that that courts are really destroying, we think, the discrimination law.
I'm speaking with employment law scholar Suja Thomas. She teaches law at the University of Illinois. She's also the co-author of a new book. It's called Unequal: How America's Courts Undermine Discrimination Law. Suja, I think to understand some of this, because I think there's sort of the, I think there's the legal world, which operates in a way that, frankly, those of us who are not lawyers don't really understand, because it seems illogical, right? So I wonder if you can just explain a little bit of the role that federal judges play in determining whether or not cases go to a jury trial, or how, what's the role? Can you explain that process?
Sure. At the beginning of a case, you file a case in court, and at that point in time, after you file your complaint, a judge can actually decide at that point in time that he or she thinks that the claim is not plausible. And if the judge thinks the claim is not plausible, the court can actually dismiss the case, and the case does not go to a jury trial. That is generally not happening. It doesn't happen usually that early in the case. But then after what's called discovery, and that is each side gives information to the other side, you might have a deposition, that is information given, basically an interview by a lawyer of another party. After information is gathered between the parties, documents, depositions, that someone will make a motion for summary judgment and say, I don't think a reasonable jury could find for the person who's brought this case. And as a result, judge, you should dismiss this case. The statistic that you mentioned earlier is the statistic that's the dismissal rate on summary judgment in many places. And then even after a case goes to trial and a jury finds for one party, let's say the plaintiff, then even then the judge can say, I don't think a reasonable jury could have found for the plaintiff. The jury was unreasonable. I'm going to order the case for the employer. So there are all these different points in time. And then even then, if the plaintiff wins at the before the jury and then the judge thinks that it's fine, the employer can then appeal. And even at that point in time, the appellate court can reverse. And it, and if you can believe this, where the jury found for the plaintiff, the case went to the appellate court and the trial court thought it was fine, the appellate court will reverse over 40% of the time.
That's remarkable. I mean, if we think about that, this is a simple question. I know it's not an easy answer. You alluded to some of this, why this is happening with this whole idea of these sort of judge-made rules. How is all of this happening? It doesn't seem like this is how the legal process is supposed to work.
Why is a difficult question to answer. One of the things that I will say is that, you know, the jury is obviously a very different body than one particular judge or even two or three judges. One, if you look at the federal system, federal judges are chosen by the President of the United States. They're some of the most, have some of the most elite backgrounds in the country. That is different than a person on a jury, for the most part, who has experienced life and oftentimes in a very different way. And that's very valuable, I think, to judge what's happening in workplaces across the country. So that's one factor. Another factor is simply that you have federal judges are more male than female. So the percentage of federal judges who are active, who are male, are 65% of federal judges versus 35% female. That obviously doesn't track the general population. So you're having actually more males than females deciding these cases. Political party is something you could try to mention, but you actually see judges of both political parties deciding cases against plaintiffs. And so that's not an easy answer to the question. There are you don't have deliberation when you don't have a jury. So those are some of, I think, the factors that are coming into play here.
You write in your book that it's time for courts to understand that there's a new politics of discrimination law. And I wonder if you think that now that we're having such a national conversation in the past few weeks regarding sexual harassment, but I'm thinking about the past year or two in terms of discrimination and everyone being much more familiar with things like microaggressions and terms like that. Do you think that the national conversation may change the culture around federal judges who, you know, by all of these examples, who are literally not really following the federal laws as they're just as the Civil Rights Act or as Title VII and all of these other laws that are supposed to protect against discrimination are written?
I wish that would be the case, but I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think that by being exposed to the fact that there is, in fact, sexual harassment in the workplace and people like Harvey Weinstein and other people at higher positions are actually engaging in that type of activity, because they see these individual cases and they think that sometimes the district courts will think that because of what the appellate court said, that they have to say that their case doesn't constitute discrimination because their case is not worse or the same as this case that was dismissed by the appellate court. You know, there's this case that someone sent to me recently as an example where the plaintiff testified he saw displays of the rebel flag on toolboxes and hard hats, the letter KKK on the bathroom wall, a block saw console, a noose in another employee's locker. Another supervisor told him if he looked at that white girl, he would cut him. And another supervisor called him black boy on one occasion. An appellate court dismissed that case as not having enough evidence of discrimination of racial harassment. And then a district court said, well, I have to dismiss my case as well because my case does not meet that standard. Almost no case is going to meet that standard. And so we have case after case where these judges who I think really don't have a good concept of what harassment should be defined as deciding these cases.
And I guess the question is how can that change? I mean, especially as you're talking about the backgrounds of these judges. I mean, at one point, I feel like I have to ask, do you feel like the judges themselves are discriminating against these cases? Because it almost sounds that way.
I think everyone in the federal judiciary probably tries to do a very good job. I think that they think over time that they have had all these doctrines and inferences that they're told to apply. Now, of course, someone's creating them, right? Some set of judges are creating them. And if they would like, they could, in fact, some of these judges could, in fact, kind of fight against this system. But as I said, you know, there's a lot of these cases are being even reversed after jury verdicts. So it's, you don't want to be the person who's going to be reversed. So I think that they think that they can make a judgment as to whether or not discrimination has occurred. And I think that that is is incorrect. And I think in order to change this, which was, I think, part of also your question, I think we're trying to, by talking about this and by writing the book, trying to inform people about what is going on. And we definitely need an amendment to some of the statutes to say that you can't use these doctrines and inferences, and also something to the effect of that we should liberally construe this language in the statutes that is right now. It's quite broad.
Do you have any hope that that may happen, especially as we've been having so many conversations about this?
I think it's going to take some time. I don't think that we're in the political climate where Congress will be taking action about this, because the context in which sexual harassment is coming up is in a context that doesn't involve the courts. I don't think that they're going to have their focus on the courts. So I think people like me and other academics and other people who are lawyers who are working in this area need to continue to talk about this and need to reach out to people in the legislature to try to make change.
Sujah Thomas is an employment law scholar. She teaches at the University of Illinois Law School. She's the co-author of Unequal, How America's Courts Undermine Discrimination Law. Sujah, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
Just so we're all on the same page, what do you mean by do it?
Open marriage, sex with other people.
Kyle, you look surprised.
And that is part of the trailer for the second season of Easy. The first season, which came out around this time last year, explored the dynamics of sex, love, and relationships through 8 episodes and multiple couples, all set around the city of Chicago. This season promises even more of the same, with new guest stars taking center stage, discussions of parenthood and open marriages, and a further look at why nothing's really all that easy. Creator Joe Swanberg is a Chicago native. He's in studio with me here to discuss the second season. Hey, Joe, welcome back.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
Yeah, so I love that this is the second season. When we talked about this with the first season, and you said you were kind of excited about a second season because it was a way to explore different parts of Chicago and also the format in which you're doing this. So maybe you can explain for folks who this was a new venture for you to go into sort of television. I mean,
yes.
I guess Netflix is television, right?
Yeah, it's definitely television, though I think this show is blurring the line between short filmmaking and television. The anthology format means that each episode is standalone, though now we're coming back to characters that we met in season one. So the TV format is sort of kicking in a little bit more in season two.
And so some of the characters we saw a couple of some of the couples are back for the second season. Mark Maron is back, his character. But all of these, the way the first season was there were a couple storylines that were continued over some episodes, but most of them were not that way.
Yeah, they were mostly standalone, and there's these little bits of overlap where certain characters in season one passed through each other's stories. And that's happening again now. The characters who are coming back are the same, you know, the same actors are playing the same characters. But I wanted to continue to expand the world as well. So we're doing 8 episodes again for season 2, and it's about half returning characters, half new characters.
And your style of how you like to shoot and create is a lot of, I don't know if you want to use the term improvise, but it's a lot of just you sort of set up a structure and then you're allowing the actors to kind of create the moments in there. Would that be a good way to describe
how you do
that?
I usually write a 5 or 6 page outline for an episode that doesn't have dialogue. It just has story points and a kind of roadmap for what the narrative will feel like, and then the actors always improvise the dialogue.
So was that different for this season then, for the second season, because you're kind of continuing a narrative?
Yeah, it was strange for me because I've never revisited characters before.
Yeah.
I've been doing this for 15 years, and I've never even thought about the idea of coming back, you know, doing a sequel to a movie or anything like that. So it's the first time that I've ever had the experience of working with actors and portraying characters who we've already met before and we've already established. So it was interesting to write the outlines this season because I already knew these people. I had a sense of the actors. A lot of the locations we already established in season one, so we were simply returning to those same spots. And yeah, it was a new thing to wrap my head around.
Was it easier or harder?
I found it harder. I think that my brain is naturally into, you know, creating things and
kind of like one and done.
Yeah. I've spent my whole career one and done. And so it was really difficult in many ways because things that I wanted to do, I thought, oh, we've already established that this person has this background. So to some degree, there were aspects that felt a little like painting myself into a corner and you know, making season one decisions and then having episode ideas in season two and thinking, oh, wait a minute, I can't do that with those characters because of this improvised line of dialogue from season one that sort of eliminates the idea of that being a possibility. But then there were other aspects that were much easier because I'm not inventing and because I have a working relationship with these actors now. So I could call them or text them and say, oh, hey, I have this idea. What do you think? And they already know the character. And so, you know, a lot of things we could skip steps that we had to go through in season one.
So when I'm thinking about this, let's take the case of Marc Maron, mm-hmm. who is a character who you had in the first season. And when you were writing the outline for that episode, so I feel like I should point out to everybody now that I had a tiny little part of that episode because I was the beginning of that episode. So yeah. I know that one really well because that's the one I talked to you about because yeah. I played myself interviewing Mark. When you were writing in the first season in the storyline of Marc Maron, who's kind of this jerk with women, did you think when you were writing the first season, oh, I'm going to come back to this guy in the second season?
I thought that I might with all the season one storylines. But the way I hope that the show will work is that we'll always come back to these characters at some point, but that there might be multiple season gaps in between. And I also knew that these actors are busy and that I might not get them back for certain seasons because they're doing a movie or have something else going on. So as we were doing season one, I never thought we're definitely coming back to these people season two, other than maybe one or two storylines that I felt this is not finished. Like the Brewery Brothers storyline from season one, they're in two of those episodes. There was almost a cliffhanger at the end of season one with what's going to happen to them. I knew, for instance, I wanted to bring that one back. But with Maron's character, I knew I wanted to visit him eventually, but I had an idea that that felt like it wanted to come back immediately for season two.
So let's actually hear a little clip of the second season of Marc Maron's storyline.
Hey, it's Karen Treska. You can leave a message after the beep. Thanks.
I did not mean to interrupt your life, to surprise you like that. I'm sorry, I can't explain it. I can explain it, but I don't want to do that right now. I just want to apologize, I'm sorry. I don't know, I'm not, I've been working on this, you know, this reissue of the book, and I've been going through all this stuff. There's so much stuff, Karen, there's so much stuff. Smashing Pumpkins, the Cubs. I don't even like baseball, you went to those games. It was nice to see you. It was just nice to see you. Even, like, it was, like, right when I walked in, before it turned to garbage. There was a moment right then when we saw each other, and I saw you. We just have dinner, like two middle-aged people that used to be married and loved each other. Let me know. Okay, bye.
Did you talk to Mark about his character and how you wanted his character to evolve?
Yeah, a lot. I mean, I love working with Mark. He's definitely a writer and an actor, which is really nice for me because of all the improv. So Mark in particular is especially good at taking the improv and, you know, building scenes live on the fly. And I knew I wanted to go back and revisit this idea of his first book, the most successful one. It's interesting because you establish all of that in season
weird.
One.
It's weird. This is very meta for us to be having this conversation.
But yeah, the what you establish in that opening scene of season one is that he had published his first book, which was a big success, and they had turned it into a movie and all this stuff. I was intrigued that maybe we were approaching the 20th anniversary of a reissue of this first book. And so the season two episode is about this 20th anniversary edition, which forces him to reconnect with his ex-wife, his first wife.
Which is a great story because he really, you know,
it did not end well.
Right. It didn't end well. And then there's a lot there. Like, that's a really juicy story, right?
Yeah. So we established that they haven't talked to each other in 8 years. And so the publishers of the book are saying, this is a love story about the two of you. We need her participation in this re-release. And so he's forced to try and reconnect with her.
I'm speaking with Joe Swanberg. He's the creator, the director, the writer behind Easy. The second season is out on Netflix on December 1st. So, Joe, what I really loved and what I think everyone in Chicago and Illinois really loved about the first season is how Chicago is kind of like this character in it. And when we talked about the first season, you said you were hoping for a second season because it was going to give you a chance to go to other neighborhoods. And you did. In this case,
you had
a chance to go south.
Yeah, we shot in Beverly this time. We shot at the Promontory in Hyde Park. We shot in Bridgeport. And yeah, each season of the show, I asked myself going into season two, where did we not get in season one? What can we do better in terms of moving around the city? And each time out, I think, you know, to some degree, we're going to be returning to characters we've already established, which is going to bring us back to neighborhoods we've been to. But with each of the new storylines, to me, that's an opportunity to try and explore a new neighborhood or meet, you know, a type of character that we haven't met before.
And so how did you do that? How did you pick? Like, how did you pick Beverly, for example? Did you pick the place before the story, or how did you do that creatively?
I didn't. I knew I wanted to get down to Beverly. I had been to Beverly to buy homebrewing equipment and had never really seen
that
neighborhood.
When was that?
Oh, this would have been 2008 or 2009.
Okay, so a while
ago. Yeah. And I was like, wow, Beverly is so interesting. It's just like
it's its own whole little place. And so you should explain Beverly for people who are not familiar.
Beverly is sort of a working class Catholic neighborhood. It seems like its history is kind of rooted in that. Really beautiful old homes. I mean, in many ways, I loved how it looked. It's pretty untouched. And the architecture is really amazing. Each house is different. You know, there's nothing cookie cutter about that neighborhood, though. It simultaneously feels kind of like suburban and, you know, a sort of older idea of Chicago.
And very unusual for Chicago, it's actually kind of it's an integrated neighborhood, too.
Sort of, though.
Integrated might not be the right word.
It definitely factors into the episode that we're talking a little bit about that. But, you know, it's way down on the south side, and it's yeah, there's different pockets. I mean, it's like any neighborhood in Chicago. It's hard to summarize the whole thing, but, you know.
So you were down there in 2008.
Yeah, and I really was, you know, sort of always interested in it. And then I had the idea for an episode about a neighborhood that's dealing with a package thief. And it required us to get an entire street, which is a tall order. You know, it's one thing to try and rent a house for an episode, but an entire block is a bit tricky when you want to take it over for a week. And so I threw Beverly out as a possibility, and my location scout came back happily reporting that Beverly would be open. You know, several streets were open to us taking over. So that's kind of how that decision making gets made. I knew I wanted to shoot something there. I had an idea, and then the two things came together. But had we, for instance, found a street in some other neighborhood, maybe we wouldn't have gotten Beverly. It wasn't a mandate.
Like on
or
Barack Obama's
like
street in Hyde Park. Yeah. Probably not going to get that one,
yeah,
right?
Maybe not this time around. I know I want to get to South Shore next season. And yeah, there's some ideas that I have that I'll purposefully be trying to shoot in those neighborhoods. But I also think that sometimes I meet, like, for instance, I met a stand-up comedian named Odinaka Ezekoli, who stars in one of the episodes this season. In that case, I cast him first, and then he just lives in Logan Square, so we ended up shooting there. You know, certain decisions get made for me.
We talked a lot about this last year, just sort of the whole notion of the theme of this is sort of loosely grouped around relationships and love and sex. Did you find that as you sort of delved into the second season, like the whole concept, which you touch on a couple episodes of the first season of open marriage and things like that, there's a lot of fodder here to continue this storyline?
Well, yeah. And what's interesting is the more we get to know these characters, the more complex I think we can get in terms of exploring some ideas that are maybe a little difficult for most shows to get into. And so what's nice about the format of Easy is that, you know, we drop out of these characters' lives for a year and then we come back. A lot can happen over the course of the year. So I think it allows us to take some chances and sort of move in directions that are maybe unexpected. But, you know, season two also is, I think, focused a lot on the idea of community. And I have several sort of bigger ensemble episodes that are dealing with, for instance, a block of neighbors. One episode is about a girl who, as punishment for something her parents say, that she has to start going back to church with them. That episode really becomes about this church community. A lot of, you know, I don't know if it's my reaction to things that are happening in the country right now, but I did feel that this season sort of opened up from this idea of these relationships into some sort of broader community themes.
Is it something you've been thinking a lot about community and the communities that we're a part of?
Yeah,
and
to me, that is definitely kicking around in my head a lot, that, you know, my own desire for community, and I guess what I feel like is maybe a national need for community right now. I think I at least am seeing a lot of isolation and a lot of, you know, people sort of, because of the internet or our phones or whatever else, kind of their social world getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And I think I did want to talk about ways in which communities of people maybe can help each other interact with each other.
I'm speaking with Chicago filmmaker Joe Swanberg. You've had a really busy year. So
I've been working on Easy
a
lot this year, and I had a film come out this year too.
So I just wanted to ask you about that, sort of how the year has gone for you.
It's been really good. I like to work. I mean, if it's not obvious from my output, I'm pretty much always working. But it was really fun in between the seasons of Easy. I had a movie called Win It All that I made with Jake Johnson that came out in March, also on Netflix. And so I got to go back and do a little bit of the festival circuit again and do some screenings. And, you know, I love Easy. It feels to me like making a film, and I'm certainly involved in all the ways that I am with a film. But it's nice to balance the TV work with feature film work. And, you know, they're both kind of flexing different muscles. So it's been a really fun year of moving between both those worlds.
And as the way that you do this, you're an independent filmmaker. A lot of this is as you sort of the structure and the world that you move in. Do you feel like, especially with your films now also being released with Netflix, do you feel like that world has opened up so much more than it was even a couple of years ago?
Definitely. I mean, I can feel the difference. I certainly know
that. Like the Amazons as well as the Netflix. Like there's so much more distribution elements out there.
And with Netflix, I would say one of the biggest aspects of that is that they're a global launch. And so as an American independent filmmaker, I've had a lot of luck in terms of showing my work around America, but, very little international distribution. And so what's really exciting is that a show like Easy and the film Win It All are being launched globally on Netflix, which means that there's just a lot more access for people around the world.
Yeah, wow. Are you going to take a break or what's next?
I'm going to take a little break. I'm sort of in the midst of a break now, and then Jake and I are writing another film that I think will be the next project. So I'll shoot something in the beginning of 2018, but I'm taking the rest of this year off.
All right. Well, that's not very much time. I like that. You're taking the rest of this year off. The second season of Easy is out on Netflix. Joe Swanberg, it's great. Thanks for being here, Joe.
Yeah, thanks for
having
me.
It was great to talk to you. Listening to the 21st, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Okay, so we all know 2017 has been a trying year, to say the least. So I thought, who better to talk about how this year has gone with author Samantha Irby? The Evanston-born Sam Irby had a great year. Her third book, We Are Never Meeting in Real Life, was released, hit the New York Times bestsellers list. She had an announcement that she's in production to develop a series for FX based on her very popular blog, Bitches Gotta Eat. The rest of us, I don't know. Not so much. Hey, Sam, welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. Thank you for having me.
So I love this
really
idea.
It was really hard to find time in my happy year.
In your happy production-filled year. And I thought, you always like to talk about how everything is garbage. And I saw a tweet around Halloween where someone suggested putting on a trash bag and going as 2017. And I thought that's very appropriate. You know, our listeners know, you know, for me, this is the year I found out that I have cancer. So that was kind of garbage.
Yeah.
But also my good side of that is that's done. So my treatment's over.
Yeah.
So maybe I should look on the positive side.
No.
How are you feeling about 2017?
This has probably been the worst year of like my adult life, right? Like it feels, at least not professionally for me, but culturally, it's been kind of a terrifying year. And it's been the kind of year where every time you turn on the news, I'm afraid to like look at Twitter to see who's trending and see why they're trending. 2017 has, I'm ready for it to be over. I think even though I had a good run, I am not without empathy for everyone else on the planet. So I think for the good of all of us, I mean, I don't know that I really believe that like the clock strikes midnight on January 1st and everything is better, but
yeah,
I'm holding out hope that this year that might be true, that next year that might be true.
So what do you
need a reset?
We need a reset. How do we reset, girl? Do we, I'm thinking like, what am I going to do for New Year's? I want to just go to bed and maybe take some heavy medication and pretend that the year did not happen.
That sounds like an excellent plan. It's so nuts to me that like the New Year is supposed to be like this fresh new start when New Year's Eve is like usually the worst day of the year. Like there's all this pressure to party and then you get to the party, it's overpriced, your feet hurt, it's not that great of a party. And then you like end up doing something you regret. And then the next day you roll into the new year, like hungover and terrible and more pessimistic, than you were the year before. So this year, I think I'm just going to like be cool, stay home, not do anything. And then hope that January 1st is like some sort of miracle takes place and everything like looks bright and shiny and new again.
Okay. How do you, I feel like, do you think, a friend of mine said to me at one point during this year that my expectations for life were too high and that I should, especially like when I, he was just like, I think you should think about your expectations for life. Like just lower them a little, because I feel like that's why you're disappointed, especially as you're going through chemotherapy. Like maybe you should just say today, like, well, I'm not in the hospital. And that should be your expectation of life.
That's a hard thing to hear. That's a super hard thing to hear, like from your friend. But I think he's right. I think that's one of the reasons that like, I would say that my general attitude is nonplussed. Right? I just am sort of like, well, I didn't aim that high. I didn't think that anything good was going to happen. So now that this marginally good thing has happened.
You had a great year.
It's okay. I did, but I also, good things happen and I'm very grateful for them. And like, I'm glad that like they let me write a book and that people bought the book and that like, things are happening, but I'm also like acutely aware of how it can never happen again.
No, so what are you talking about? This is not a zero sum game. There's not like just because you had good things happen doesn't mean bad things happen. You're like, that's not how I don't believe that's how life works.
Well,
but is this year?
Oh,
this is it. You're doing it. You're lowering your expectations. You're doing it right now.
Yes. I am always waiting for the other shoe to drop, right? So, like, the day my editor called and said, hey, you made the bestseller list. I was in the back of a cab in downtown Chicago. I was coming from Union Station and I was super excited. And then I immediately was like, oh, what a high bar to set for the next one.
So you gave yourself a full 30 seconds of pleasure before you went immediately to, okay.
Yes. Yeah. I feel like my life has been a series of like the other shoe dropping. And so I'm just like, I'm always like cautiously optimistic, but not really. I just like to be ready for the bad thing. And if it never comes, like, that's cool. But if it does, then it's like, well, at least I was prepared.
And so it's so funny because, you know, I'm the exact opposite of you, where I always think the best thing is going to happen. I'm just always expecting happiness and joy everywhere. And I'm just like, well, everything's great. And interestingly,
I love you for that. Like, I love being around positive people, but I don't know where your faith comes from.
I don't either. Because
I wish I had it.
I think it's just because I have to say the interesting thing is having cancer didn't really change that, which is interesting. And I should note to our audience, Sam and I are recording this conversation because I am taking some time off. So those of you who are listening will know that you've been hearing encore editions of the 21st. While this is playing, I'm going to be on a beach somewhere recovering from this year. Sam, yes. So other than like adjusting attitude, how do you recommend that we all take care of ourselves at this time of the year?
I would say understand, like, know, and this is a buzzword and I hate to use it, but it's
self-care.
Know what you're, no. That one I can't say. And I believe in it, but I can't say it. I am still negative enough that I cannot talk about self-care, but I will say you should know what your triggers are, right? Like, if the holiday movie is gonna make you cry, don't watch it. Or, like, if going down a news rabbit hole is going to make you feel, like, despair for the world, which that often happens to me, don't watch the news. I would say, like, avoid, if you can, the things that you know are going to upset you. You know, we always hear about people like going to Thanksgiving and there's like the uncle they fight with and it ruins the whole thing. Don't invite him this year.
Or just watch Love Actually. Love Actually is the movie I love to watch because it makes me cry, but it makes me happy because it's my favorite holiday.
Yeah.
It's my favorite non-religious holiday song, All I Want for Christmas Is You.
See, I can't watch any of those movies because
they make you sad.
I watch a movie like that and I like want to go back in time and like punch my parents for never giving me a good Christmas experience. And now I know that I can't watch that, so I don't. I'll watch something else. But like, I feel like you have to know what upsets you and avoid it. And while doing a lot of the thing that makes you happy, at least for the two months, but month and a half that covers like the blanket holiday season.
January's the worst. January's the worst because it's cold and we're all broke.
But if you spent all of December not fighting with the one sister you hate while like drinking cartons of eggnog or whatever it is that makes you like feel whatever your temporary emotional band-aid is, then like January is a little bit like less horrible, right? I mean, this is my version of optimism.
Yeah, I really like
Band-Aid
this. So how can collectively
over it and just hold on?
Collectively, how can we make 2018 less of a garbage year? Do you love that I'm asking you all these deep
practical
life questions?
Yes, I do. So, okay, I don't know how to give practical advice, right? Because I'm not a practical person. So I'm not going to tell you to, like, vote.
No, you should just make us laugh.
Like, judges and all that stuff. Right. Yes. My thing to make 2018 better, I strive to do this in my life. Cut off everyone who irritates you. This is the year that, like, you stop listening to people who get on your nerves. I have stopped doing that. And, like, it doesn't matter. Sister, brother, mom, dad, If they're not adding to your life, get them out of it.
Okay, just
I feel
get
like
them
that's
out.
The first,
that's step one. Step one.
Like, you don't have control over so many things, but one of the things you absolutely have control over is who you let impact your day. And, like, really, this is the only reasonable thing I ever do for myself is, like, once somebody's got to go, I just make them go.
And then what are
and
your,
then, like,
yeah.
Better.
And then that life is better. What about your guilty pleasures or your things that make you happy?
Well, I could talk about all day. I don't know that it's a guilty pleasure, but I watch a lot of TV. TV gets a bad rap, and like sitting around watching TV, like
I love,
you know,
TV.
Me too. And like I don't feel like I should be, you know, appreciating nature while I'm watching it. I'm like, no, you know what I should be doing? Sitting on this couch for 8 hours marathoning this show. If they didn't want us to watch TV, they wouldn't release whole seasons at a time.
So you could just sit there for 2 days and not talk to anyone that bothers you and just binge watch something.
Noise canceling headphones, a blanket, and a corner of the couch is like all I need. So it's my non-guilty pleasure. And like I have the kind of like non-job where I can sort of pretend that like being up on the cultural zeitgeist is like part of the job.
So what's your favorite end of the year binge watching? Or just this year? What's been your favorite binge watching?
I just got into the show Younger. Have you watched that?
No, what's that about?
So it's this woman who is in her 40s and has a college-age daughter. She took time out of the workforce. She was in publishing.
Like Gilmore Girls?
She took time. Yeah. Yes. A little hipper. Less small-towny because they're in New York. And, like, she took, you know, 20 years off to raise her kid, and now she wants to get back in the workforce. And, of course, publishing, you need to be like 25 and hip. So she pretends that she is 25 and gets a job at a publishing house. I mean, it's a fantasy, okay? And she lives half of her life as like this 40-year-old mom, and her professional life, she's pretending to be a 25-year-old intern. And it's amazing. Hilary Duff is in it.
What? All right. Well, that's...
Yeah, and Mariska Hargitay's husband. I don't know his name, but he is a dreamboat. So that is what I've been watching.
This is great. These have
totally
been...
mature. What did you think I was going to say? Ken Burns?
There's the Vietnam War documentary that you could also watch to cheer yourself up. All right.
Yeah.
So... Samantha Irby, if you haven't read her books, We're Never Meeting in Real Life. Maybe a good one for January. New Year, Same Trash, Resolutions I Did Not Keep. Sam, should we say, I'm going to say Happy New Year to you early. And I'm going to say, I hope you have as better a 2018 than you did of 2017, my friend.
You too.
We can't end the year, I can't end the year, without thanking the incredible team behind the 21st. You hear my voice every day. There are lots of people at Illinois Public Media who make this show happen every day. So for our last show of the year, I want to extend a special thanks to Robin Lynn, Alan Montecelio, Bob Holly, and Christine Herman, our producers who have worked on the show over the year, our interns, Libby Foster and Grace Stetson, who have been such a great help these past couple of months, Jason Croft and Steve Mork, who do all of our engineering and technical direction, and Scott Cameron, who runs the ship. I also want to thank the folks at the University of Illinois Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help, and special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, broadcasting today from the Medill Graduate School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. Thanks for listening. Have a happy new year. Stay safe out there.